Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. The time is 9:35 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson and Senator Stevens are away on other state business. Today is moving day for the legislature in the sense that the ferry is running today, and so this is there may be people or staff away from the building right now trying to move their belongings home. On today's agenda, we have SB 193, Medicaid Assistant Work Requirement. It's an act requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a waiver to establish work requirements for certain adults who are eligible for the state medical assistance program. On April 12, 2018, we heard the bill and a sectional analysis. We opened and closed the public hearing, and we have yet to cover the fiscal notes. If I could invite Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Kelly to the microphone for a brief overview. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Ms. Carpenter, if you could identify yourself for the record and give us an overview of what the bill before us does.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. Just as a brief overview, Senate Bill 193 takes advantage of a new CMS rule that allows states to apply using an 1115 waiver to have work requirements for certain able-bodied populations of the Medicaid program. This bill would specifically require 20 hours of work for those individuals, and it would exempt volunteerism if you're actively searching for a job, caregiving, certain parts of caregiving, and subsistence activities. On page 2 of the bill, there is a list of specific exemptions that we tried to line up as much as possible with our current temporary assistance for needy families program. Some of those include if you are, you have to be 18 to 64 in order to have the work requirement. There are exemptions for if you're a parent or a caregiver of a child or somebody in your family who needs 24-hour care. There's exemptions if you are pregnant, if you're currently receiving unemployment insurance benefits, if you're participating in a tribal work program. And there are also temporary exemptions if you are experiencing a family hardship outside of your control and if you're a victim of domestic violence. A couple of the other highlights in regard to CMS guidelines is that we're ensuring that this program does not prevent a recipient with substance abuse disorder from obtaining appropriate treatment. So that's just the high-level review of what this bill is.
Are there questions? Bless you. Are there questions on what Senate Bill 193 does? Senator Bishop, if you could go through two of the fiscal notes, fiscal note 1 and 8, and then I'll call the Department of Health and Social Services to the microphone, Mr. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first fiscal note is 2771. That's the Department of Administration. The appropriation is Centralized Administrative Services. And allocation is to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Fiscal year 19, the cost is $338,900. Fiscal year 20 is $451,800. Fiscal year 21 and beyond is $564,000. Analysis, Department of Health projects that the denials and terminations of the Medicaid eligibility pursuant to the new requirements would generate 188 appeals in FY 2020, 251 appeals in 2021, 314 in subsequent years. Our experience in calendar year 2017 shows a cost per case of approximately $1,800 for these types of appeals. OAH does not currently have the capacity to handle this caseload. We would expect to staff the new caseloads with a total of 3 full-time range, 24 administrative law judges, one to be added at the beginning of fiscal year 2020, one approximately halfway through that year. The third would be hired at the beginning of fiscal year 22. At all times, the workload projected by DHSS would somewhat exceed the capacity of these new hires, and excess work would be handled by the judges working on contract. The shortfall to be handled by the contract peaks in 2021 and declines to a lower level thereafter. Each newly hired full-time administrative law judge would be sent to the National Judicial College to attend its training on conducting hearings related to the federal benefits program, travel expenses related to the training, as well as commodities purchases to equip the new judges with offices. Materials and hearing technology fall primarily between 2020 and 2022. The second fiscal note, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the appropriation is employment and training services. The allocation is workforce services. OMB component is 2761. The cost is zero. This legislation will likely increase traffic to the Alaska job centers, which may result in increased wait time for Alaskans seeking assistance with career services. There is no fiscal impact to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development as a result of this legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Are there questions for the Department of Administration or the Department of Labor on the fiscal notes provided in Fiscal Note 1 and Fiscal Note 8? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Deputy Commissioner Sherwood and Monica Windham, the Director of the Division of Public Assistance, to the microphone to cover fiscal notes 2 through 7. And if we could pause at the end of each fiscal note, going through it so we can see if we have questions. Welcome to Senate Finance. Your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm John Sherwood. I am the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Good morning. My name is Monica Windham. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance.
Madam Chair, before going through the individual fiscal notes, I thought it would be helpful to give a brief overview so people have context about what they're hearing in each individual fiscal note. There are six fiscal notes from the department. Three of them are related to the administrative activities of doing this program. Three of them are Medicaid services fiscal notes and reflect reductions in Medicaid services expenditures, as that we project that one of the impacts of this bill is it will reduce caseloads as people choose not to cooperate with or comply with the work requirements. So also to sort of give you the summary impact, under the federal policy, work supports provided to individuals are not eligible for federal matching funds. The Medicaid administrative portions are, and the Medicaid services are. So there's kind of a disproportionate impact to federal and state funds as a result of this, with much of the savings coming from expenses that are eligible for federal funding, and a substantial amount of the expense coming from services that are not eligible for federal funding. So, overall and in total budget, the combined impact of these fiscal notes would be to reduce the total budget. It would result in an increase in the general fund budget. Going through the individual fiscal notes, the first fiscal note for the Department of Administration, fiscal note number 2, is the public assistance field services fiscal note. That's really involves the work that goes into working with the clients, informing them of the work requirements, making the determination of whether or not they're complying with the work requirements, that kind of thing. I think Director Windham can provide more detail. There is some startup cost in FY19 of $173,000 in 2020. That grows to about $6.5 million, and then decline somewhat over the next several years as we expect people fail to comply with the work requirements and the caseload is reduced. The work that goes into that would also reduce, and to do this work would require 49 positions in FY 2020, declining to 45 positions in the out years. So I'll pause there. If you have more detailed questions about this, we'd be happy to answer them.
Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, I just would say that this is one of the most interesting fiscal notes that I've seen. I appreciate the detail that you have, and it appears that the department does not want to do this. I'll just leave it at that. Senator Bishop.
I apologize, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherwood, I didn't hear the bill number, the fiscal note number.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it's fiscal note number 2 and OMB component 236.
Thank you, sir.
It has $6.1 million for a capital project to update ARIES to be, or is that accurate, to update ARIES so that the Medicaid system can appropriately reflect this work component?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number 3, OMB component 234, is quality control. This is the budget allocation where we put our fair hearing work as previously placed on the record by Senator Bishop. It involves the Office of Administrative Hearings. This includes both our RSA for the work that's done by the Department of Administration, as well as our own staff that represents the department in fair hearings. And we do expect, as we deny or terminate individuals for failure to comply with the work requirements, that we will have an increase in fair hearings. So there's, again, a very small startup cost of $20,000. In FY 2020, there is a cost of $490,200, growing to $591,000 in FY 2021. $704,000 in 2022, $686,000 in 2023, and $684,000 in 2024. There would be one additional position associated with the fair hearing representation, and there's no capital expenditures.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. When the bill was presented earlier, a few minutes ago, the presenter talked about a program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, TANF, and how the bill requirements, work requirements, are structured similar around that program. So I guess the question that I have for you is, how many people participate in TANF right now in the work requirements, and what do you know what that budget is to manage that program in your department?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we have about 3,000 cases a month for ATAP. Unduplicated is about 5,000. I did check. In some areas, we contract that work out. In some areas, we have state staff that do it. I checked the figures in the Anchorage area. We have about 1,500 folks that are mandatory for work programs for TANF, and we have a contract with Nine Star to handle that work, and that contract is $3 million a year.
Ms. Windham, thank you for that response. Senator Von Imhoff.
So I just want to make sure. So it's 3 million, about 1,500 people in Anchorage.
Correct.
And you outsource it to Nine Star. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about whether maybe this program, if it should pass, would make sense to outsource some or part of or all of it?
Through the chair, it appears that it would likely cost more if we did that, because we determined about, I believe it's 25,000 people would be mandatory for the work requirements for Medicaid. So if you do the math, it would actually be more if we contracted it out at the same rate that we are for TANF clients?
I have to think about what I'm hearing.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the nine-star contract consists of, that's a $3 million a year contract, and it consists of what services do they provide?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, when someone is referred to nine-star, they meet with a case manager. That person talks to the client to determine what their barriers are for work. They complete a self-sufficiency plan that shows all the steps that that person needs to take to become self-sufficient. They may place them in a volunteer position, perhaps, may provide training for them, help them with the resume, a structured job search.
Follow up.
Senator Bishop.
And to include a GED if they're...
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions on fiscal note number 3, OMB component number 234? With that, we can move on to fiscal note number 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number 4, Public Assistance Work Services, OMB component 2337, reflects the actual cost of providing work services to individuals who are subject to the work requirements. We had estimated that about 10.5% of our total Medicaid enrollment would be subject to these work requirements, and that we would have non-compliance of 5% the first year, 10%, or excuse me, 15% the first year, 20% the second year, and 25% in subsequent years. So this involves providing work services to a substantial number of people each year, at a cost of approximately $1,000 per person. There are no capital expenses associated with it. And as I mentioned, this is the part of the CMS policy that indicated that these supportive services are not eligible for federal funding, so these would be all general funds.
Senator Maticki?
I don't have any questions at the moment, ma'am.
Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number 5 is Medicaid Services, Behavioral Health, Medicaid Services, OMB Component 2660. And as I mentioned, we expect that there will be a reduction in Medicaid caseloads as a result of some percentage of non-compliance with the program, starting at 15% in 2020, growing to 20% in FY 2021 and 25% from FY 2022 on, and therefore this will reduce the Medicaid spend for reduction of those individuals, and the Medicaid is reduction is allocated between three of the four Medicaid services components: behavioral health, adult preventive dental Medicaid services, and the healthcare Medicaid services. There is no reduction to the senior and disability Medicaid services because the people receiving those services would be exempt from work requirements, pretty much as a class. For the behavioral health, we project that the reduction would be approximately $4.6 million in 2020, $6.2 million in 2021, and then $7.7 million in 2022 and beyond. Again, there's no positions or capital expenditures associated with that fiscal note.
Are there questions from committee members on this fiscal note? Seeing and hearing none, let's move to fiscal note number 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number 6 is adult preventive dental Medicaid services, OMB component 2839. Again, this is part of the allocated reduction in Medicaid services as a result of caseload reduction. In FY 2020, that would be $494,300. In FY 21, it would be $659,100. And then in FY 2022, it would be $823,900. And the same for the out years. Again, no capital costs or positions associated with that reduction.
Questions from committee members? Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number 7 is healthcare Medicaid services, OMB component 2077. Again, this is the allocated reduction in Medicaid services based on the reduction in the Medicaid caseload, and this is the largest component of that reduction. As you can see in FY 2020, it's approximately $25.8 million. In FY 2021, it's $34.4 million. In FY 22, it's $42.9 million, and again, the same in the out years, with no capital costs or positions associated with the fiscal note.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going back to the previous question about outsourcing. You indicated you were unsure about whether there would be, in fact, savings if you outsourced it. Do you think maybe having an RFP process and just testing the waters to see what kind of comes up might make sense? We are looking at a total of a $28.8 million fiscal note when you add all this up, and that is a big nut. And perhaps there are entities out here. We're looking to expand revenue options here in the state and invest in new businesses and so forth. So maybe it might make sense to do an RFP to see if there is a data management company that could rise to the challenge for something like this.
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing I omitted when we were talking about that is the possibility that we won't be reimbursed by Medicaid for anything that we contract out for the work services piece, because their guidance has said that they won't pay for specific work services. However, state staff, we use an allocation code to we end up paying about 50% for our staff, not 100%. So there's that factor too. Certainly, if we were to pursue an 1115 waiver for the work requirements, we could submit an RFI, which is a request for information, and that's a little less formal than an RFP, but it would tell us if there are interested parties out there and what they might charge us for it.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow up.
So the process would be to obtain a waiver and then do an RFI, is that correct?
We could do them at the same time, I believe. I'm not the procurement specialist, but I believe we can put an RFI out at the same time that we're pursuing the waiver.
Thank you, Ms. Wyndham. Any other questions? I'd like to go back to two fiscal notes, one for fiscal note number 2236, the public assistance and the 49 employees that the department is requesting. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood or Ms. Wyndham, I understand the cost associated with the capital money and trying to update the system. I have a hard time with the 49 positions. Can you go into some detail as to why the department believes it needs 49 new technicians on employment services when we have a Department of Labor that usually handles those kind of things? So can you help me there with why this would fit with your department?
When we were determining the fiscal note, we looked at the services that we provide to our ATAP clients. Our ATAP clients, as I described before, what Nine Star does is meet with them and do the self-sufficiency plan, and we have state staff in other areas that do the same. We'll have to discuss this with Mr. Harvey, who is sitting in the audience, but I don't believe that they provide that detail of service.
Why
the self-sufficiency plans.
And is that required through Medicaid? I mean, when I go get a job, I typically don't go anywhere except to the employer and ask for a job. So why do you think we need sufficiency plans?
The guidance from CMS says that if we pursue the work requirement for Medicaid, we have to provide supportive services to that client to help them seek a job.
And do you have to, or can the Department of Labor do that, or as indicated earlier, can we contract out that support with someone else?
As long as someone with the state or a contract that we're paying for provides those services, that should be sufficient.
From a technical perspective, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, if we were to add 49 positions, what does that do to our pension contribution rate? And so that's the second question. The first question would be, when we add 49 positions, if we reflectively look at your vacancy rate, how many dollars are associated with that actual vacancy rate, and when do you anticipate filling those positions versus requesting 49 new positions?
Madam Chair, I apologize. I can't tell you what the vacancy rate factor would be built in. It would be the same vacancy factor that we use for budgeting. You are correct that we would assume that there's always a certain degree of vacancy. We would anticipate filling those positions in 2020 to bring this up. And the positions do decline slightly over time as the actual caseload declines. And again, as regard to the pension contributions, I can't tell you the impact of those. I will say that we would expect going into the negotiations with CMS on 1115 waiver to have discussions with them about what our options were in terms of receiving reimbursement for some of the work that could be characterized as administrative work as opposed to the work supports, to see whether our assessment of the advantages of providing these services directly versus contracting was accurate. I think we would consider if it was feasible doing contracting, but for the purposes of this fiscal note, I guess I would say we kind of are taking the approach of better safe than sorry. It's not clear to us that that would be the most advantageous way to proceed financially. If we were to try and do the administrative work through a contract, and then we're also doing work services, they would have to assume their own burdens of accounting and timekeeping to differentiate between those activities. So going into this, we believe that there's a degree of certainty to taking the approach that we put out in this fiscal note, where there's a much higher degree of uncertainty around the viability of contracting some of this.
Senators, it's only a personal opinion. I've been in service in the legislature and serving on the Finance Committee for 10 years, and I don't believe I've ever seen this much of an ask with this many employees, and I'm concerned that the department is requesting support beyond the actual need to implement the program. And so I'm uncertain what to do on fiscal note number 2 and fiscal note number 4. And so I'm wondering whether we should either eliminate the additional requests for personnel, because the vacancy factor we found in other areas do not have dollars associated with them to actually put people to work. And so that's the number, Deputy Commissioner, that I'm trying to get to. We have a whole bunch of PCNs that are sitting there that may be hollow PCNs right now, and not understanding that or having clarity in that, I have a hard time funding, from a personal perspective, 49 positions that we're going to attach funding to and then increase the state's contribution to the PERS system based on those PCN counts versus just providing the money to actually fund the current positions. So I look for guidance from the Senate finance team, whether they share my concerns, whether this fiscal note should be modified by the Senate Finance Committee, or whether we should send it out with 49 positions specifically on public assistance and looking for work support when I think we have a Department of Labor or contracting process that could be much more functional. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a couple years ago, we did do a Medicaid expansion where we added tens of thousands of new enrollees, I think approximately about 40,000 new enrollees over the last couple years. How many new state employees were hired to handle this volume with Medicaid eligibility, which is pretty complicated, and processing, of course, all the claims and so forth. So how many new employees were hired to handle this?
Through the Ms. Chair, Wyndham. Senator Von Imhoff, we hired no additional employees, but we also have a backlog of Medicaid applications of about 17,000.
May I follow up?
Senator Von Imhoff.
Was that so that's very interesting to know. Was the backlog due to like a Xerox, like a computer malfunction? I thought I heard the last year for sure that it was a good chunk of it was due to a computer and technology issue.
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there's a variety of things that have contributed to the backlog. Certainly, we have had some computer issues. The ARIES system did come up later than expected. Our caseworkers are working in two different systems right now because we haven't been able to add all the other programs to the ARIES system. So, and the expansion also, you can see when you look at, I don't have them with me now, but when you look at charts that show the growth of the backlog, it certainly did increase after we expanded.
Madam Chair, I'm going to take the liberty to ask one last question.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. With this backlog being in being the case, why haven't you looked at potentially doing then a temporary outsourcing to help with the backlog to get it caught up?
We have to. The federal regulations say merit staff have to authorize Medicaid benefits as well as SNAP. So it has to be a state employee.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, to address the backlog, the department has requested 41 new positions. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
And 49 here, almost at 100, Senator Hoffman. Senator Bishop.
Well, thank you. It helped me here. I might be reading this wrong, but it appears we're targeting about 2,200 people and change that this bill would affect.
22,000.
10% of those are within this. Is it 10% of 22,000? So we're looking at 2,200 people we're looking at trying to put back to work, or 22,000 people you want to put to work?
Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, 22,000. The 10% is the percent of all Medicaid recipients. So we looked at our caseload to see what Medicaid recipients were working already, which Medicaid recipients had children or were children, and we got to about 10.5% when we took out everybody that might be exempt from this requirement, and then the national study showed that about 10% of people would be mandatory for work if that was a requirement for Medicaid. So we were pretty close to the national average.
Senator Michicki.
Seems to be not a lot of credit given toward entire families no longer needing to be on Medicaid. This is an interesting approach from the department for me. I mean, I'll tell you that almost a third of Alaskans are on Medicaid. The last year count I have is 219,000, but 60% of them are healthy adults and children from those families, where we spent about $1.2 billion. And that's 85% of the spend, right? So I'm curious. I want those families to succeed wildly, which would also remove the children. I mean, that's kind of the idea, right? We put folks back to work, and they find out that, by golly, they're going to be the best in some field that they could be, and they succeed, and they don't need to any longer be on any aspect of Medicaid. Did you not give any credit for the children that would also be removed from the rolls because their parents are working and successful as opposed to having to depend on the government for their health care?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we did not estimate a number of children, a particular number of children going off for a couple of reasons. One is when you look at the exemptions, the exemptions include exemptions for certain parents. The other is so that it's more likely exemptions would apply to individuals in families. The other is that the income eligibility standards for children are higher than adults, so an income a modest income that might eliminate an adult from eligibility would not necessarily eliminate a child from eligibility. Given our lack of experience and overall the lack of experience with these kind of programs throughout the country, we didn't feel comfortable making the assumption that this would substantially reduce children's coverage.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just natural that as families do realize that success, and I think there's an aspect of breaking the cycle. Some of those children will come off. I think it's a given, but on breaking the cycle and helping people to realize their own potential, the future savings. I mean, it looks like you're constructing these fiscal notes to more or less have an ongoing dependence on Medicaid, and I think there's a larger percentage of people that will succeed and no longer be in that position and will take their children with them, and their children will learn in the next generation that they have an expectation of not being dependent on the government. I mean, I realize you're being conservative, in my view, overly conservative. I'm resistant about the new positions to streamline eligibility into Medicaid as well because of the same reasons. I think we've made it too easy. I have a higher expectation that people can succeed wildly. And I think we've put tools, I think we've put obstacles in the way of that success. So I think it's clear that there should be more credit on less utilization from healthy families and children because the adults have moved away from that dependence. And you've given no credit to that probability.
Commissioner Sherwood, do you have a thought?
Madam Chair, I guess I would say that we do see people move off of Medicaid right now. There are people coming and going from Medicaid all the time. So it's very difficult to estimate the impact this is going to have on really elevating people off of Medicaid long-term versus simply assuring that they stay engaged in the workforce or through other acceptable activities during this, as they experience an economic setback. I would not probably debate the concept that implementing this requirement would over the long-term change things, the attitudes. The question is really, when would we see those impacts and how big those impacts would be? And when we go into these kind of really new things, we do our best to come up with what we think are reasonable assumptions and avoid making highly speculative guesses. And so that's the position we found ourselves when we did these fiscal notes. I think my only other comment is that with regard to the positions, one thing that's different from these work requirements than a lot of work we do, which is most of the eligibility work we do is really done on an annual or 6-month renewal basis with reports of change. But in a number of these cases, we would expect, as you're seeing people do the self-sufficiency plans and compliance, that really involves pretty much ongoing monitoring of the case. So more touching of the case, if you will, than our typical eligibility processes. We have done what we can to streamline eligibility and minimize the amount of contact we have to have with each case, and still do it, you know, a reasonable job of accurately determining eligibility. But this kind of requirement does require, if you will, a higher touch. And so when you look at the positions and try and make comparisons to some of the other work we do, it's not necessarily a good apples-to-apples comparison.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherwood, I got two questions, ma'am. The 1115 waiver, how many pages is that to fill out, and how much do you have a ballpark, and how much staff time would be required to get that waiver?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we really haven't calculated the pages. It's not insignificant. However, this is, but 1115 waivers can range from something very simple to very complicated. There are waivers that run in the hundreds of pages, and there are waivers that run in the tens of pages. I think this one will require us to provide a lot of evidence to CMS that we've provided the appropriate exceptions, and we are going to have mechanisms to provide the appropriate supports. And of course, all waivers are subject to cost neutrality. We did include some very modest startup costs in terms of getting ready for this, including expenditures on an actuary to help us with the cost neutrality determination. I think most of the rest of it is around developing regulations. It will certainly require policy work on our part and negotiations. We won't be the first state doing this, but every state that's done it has probably put forward something a little bit different. So we will we're in the process of doing a negotiation around a behavioral health 1115 waiver now. It is time consuming, and it does take our resources, but largely it takes our policy resources. We expect to support it with a, if you will, a minimal amount of additional resources.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick one follow up.
Senator Bishop.
On your departmental analyses that you used to come to this 22,840 number, did you identify the top one, two, or three barriers to employment?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we don't have that information for Medicaid recipients, so there would be no way for us to gather data on that right now.
Senator Bishop?
Interesting.
So, committee members, again, it's unusual. I'm thinking of striking all the employees and directing the administration to work with the Department of Labor. The point that I don't know if we strike all of the employees because the department has plenty of PCNs. I think just in OCS alone we had 60 some vacancies. When I met privately with the director, I believe that a majority of those don't have funding associated with them, or many of those don't. Maybe it's not a majority. What does the committee think about that? I'm not trying to take the money away, but I don't see the need to reinvent the wheel in the Department of Health and Social Services for labor issues. Comments from committee members. Senator Michiki.
Madam Chair, I support that. I think the department has a desire for additional employees for a lot of different reasons, and the reality of it is the cost of Medicaid is something that has to be managed. There are many different ways to manage it, but this is one method, I think. And I would support the fact that we need to find a creative way to deal with a work requirement that doesn't require 40-plus additional employees.
So, Senator Hoffman.
I don't know about that. How does all of this fit into the fact that we're trying to find employment for 22,000 people? The jobs in Alaska are on the decline. People are leaving the state of Alaska. And I don't know about Anchorage and Fairbanks. You know, I see our unemployment rate nationally going down. But that is not the case in Alaska. It seems to be stabilized at a rate. Alaska used to have an unemployment rate that was lower than the national average, but today it's substantially higher than the national average. And I'm wondering, how does this interplay with the success of the program and the whole intent of the legislation? How do we look at if the current estimates by the department are 10% and trying to get 22,000 jobs, that in and of itself is very, very ambitious. So I would have to think about how that interplays with the whole success of the program and how, and maybe listening to the Alaska Department of Labor to see how all of this may interplay.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't totally disagree with what you're saying, but from just the question I had a few moments ago about what's the barrier to employment to these 23,000 people, and it's not a dig on you, ma'am, or your, but we're trying to fix a problem. We don't even know if we did do the data dump to see if they're employable at all, and what are the employers, the barriers to employment. This number could shrink. I think there needs to be a data dive on those and take an assessment on those 22,000 employees, one, to see if they're employable, number two, to see where their skill sets are so we know where to put the assets. And because the last thing I'll say is that if I was king for a day, I'd like to see both commissioners from the Department of Labor and Hess telling us what they think about that.
Senator Jiggy.
You know, just to be clear, our unemployment rate is almost always higher in the lower 48. The only time it's not is when the lower 48 is in deep recession. And in the worst of our recession, we lost 0.1%, being in the 7-point whatever range. We're talking about folks that are not in the worker rolls normally. Less than half, in the lowest per capita in the U.S., working is in the state of Alaska. That's something we have to improve. But remember, this bill doesn't talk about a requirement to work. It talks about a requirement to contribute. They can volunteer. They can do a lot of other things. And my only point is that we are squeezing out across the country the disabled and seniors for services on the money we're spending for healthy adults and their families that should be led to a greater opportunity of success. I'd rather spend the same amount or more breaking that cycle on helping those people to reach their success, where it's volunteering today and training for something that they can do in the future. If we spent the same amount or more and taught a work ethic and gave them opportunities, I mean, you don't know that the next Pasteur is out there, or someone who's going to cure cancer, that we have put something in the way of their success because we've made it too easy. So I think it's important on so many levels, and I do agree with you that we need to look for opportunities, and we need to determine and separate those that are employable because of the skills they have today from those that need help with additional skills. But I'm willing to invest in developing those skills so that those individuals can reach that level of success.
Again, my intent is to zero the bodies, but not necessarily the money, so that we can actually contract out with a nonprofit or do a governmental receipt exchange with the Department of Labor to be able to provide these services. The issue is that the department is standing up a whole unit, per se, to handle the employment side of the house with some of the skills maybe sitting over in the Department of Labor. I think of my community, Eagle River, and the loss of our job center, and whether we can react and what the cost associated with those positions might be. The employment service technician that the Department of Health and Social Services is giving us ranges from $85,000 per person up to $119,000 per person to help someone find a job. There has got to be a more economic way to find jobs for folks than, and I guess the lowest one on there is $66,000 from their projections. I think that we can do it much better with a private nonprofit or an intergovernmental relationship with the Department of Labor. So the first thing I need to know is whether there's support to eliminate the added positions, and then we can work on the fiscal numbers, which I'm much, much less aggressive on the dollar value than the position. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to reiterate Senator Michiki's comments that there is never a shortage of volunteer opportunities. So there might be jobs shortage or particular jobs in certain skill sets, but there is never a shortage of volunteer across the board. And this bill is permissible for that. Madam Chair, in regards to the fiscal note and your ideas, yes, there's potentially a lot of holes. Would outsourcing help? We don't know without getting an RFP or an whatever you call it, RI. You've made a comment of you cannot have state employees can only process Medicaid eligibility, which is why you haven't outsourced it. I can't refute that right now because I don't have information, but in some of my research, I thought that other states have outsourced part of their Medicaid eligibility. I'm going to research that because I feel that there is there's some opportunity there that perhaps your department is not fully taking advantage of for whatever reason. Madam Chair, my last comment, I don't feel comfortable really moving forward of striking the entire fiscal note. You made a comment of maybe rebuilding the fiscal note. If that is the case, I would actually like to have an at ease, or I'm going to remain neutral on that comment because I do not have enough information to respond accurately.
Senator Bishop.
I think what the chair said was cutting positions, not cutting the money.
Correct.
To a point. So for clarity on that point, this for me, I still go back at the end of the day. You got 22,000 people here. If we were going to do some really good work inside this bill, I would throw this out on the table that there need to Department of Labor works with HESS. I want to know what those 22,000 people, where they're at with their skill sets, are they employable? Because at the end of the day, I want them to have a job. I don't want them volunteering. I want them volunteering after they've pulled a 10-hour shift 6 days a week. That's when I want them volunteering. Thank you.
Senator Michiki.
Madam Chair, I support the reduction in employees, and I would like to see a lower fiscal note than the full amount. There has to be some creativity, and if there are the obstacles in CMMS that we need to fix, then we need to work on a federal fix as well. I don't know how much ACA wrapped all of these things into one ball that encourages enrollment and eligibility, but that's something we have to work on. We're not going to fix that in this, but I would like to see the department become as creative as they can with using outside sources whenever possible.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherwood, if the positions weren't here, do you feel the department is going to be able to comply with the legislation?
Through the chair, Chair Hoffman, I think that's a difficult question to answer because we can only do this through an 1115 demonstration waiver that has to be approved by CMS. CMS has laid down some pretty strict guidelines about what it will take to get that waiver approved. I would say that their policy was written with defending litigation around this issue in mind. So there are a lot of requirements imposed upon states who move forward to ensure that the individuals subject to these requirements have adequate protection. I am not clear that we could get a waiver approved without those positions on the other hand, it might be possible to get a waiver approved with less than the full positions requested, but we don't have certainty. As I said before, this is the way we have reasonable certainty that we could move forward and meet the requirements that are imposed by the CMS policy. And if you are looking for the most certainty that we can move forward with this waiver, these positions are the way we are most certain that we can move forward.
So I guess the question is, do we go about trying to address the problem a different way, or do we want to give the legislation the best possible chance by funding these positions to get the job done? And whether or not the answer that Mr. Sherwood is giving leaves open for negotiations to have a different fiscal note along the lines of Senator Von Imhoff. So do we want success? Do we don't want success? And where are we going to have that with this substantial fiscal note? There are other larger fiscal notes, but by the way, so.
Senator Hoffman, I think we want success, and I think that this fiscal note overstates the need, quite frankly. That's just my opinion. That's why I'm throwing it out to the committee. 50 positions is a round number that the department continues to give us in multiple fronts, trying to get more bodies in the Department of Health and Social Services for Medicaid expansion. And by expansion, I'm not talking about an individual population. I'm talking about the growth in the overall deployment of those assets to all the people of Alaska who qualify without consideration of whether the state has the general fund dollars to be able to support it. And I just don't think, again, this is one senator's perspective, that we need to hand out 49 positions when we have positions on the book that I believe we do not have funding associated with any longer. And so I think that providing the funds for the positions that have been depleted of those resources is one way to allow this to move forward successfully without having to create these new PCNs that will just be numbers on the books, which is why I asked the first question of the deputy commissioner, how many PCNs are out there with no money associated with them that are currently part of the vacancy factor? And we don't know the answer to that question today.
But to follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
To look on page 2 of the fiscal note that we're discussing, it says, the first sentence says that 20 hours of work is required to get the 1115 waiver times 22,000 individuals. You're talking about 440,000 individuals. And although Mr. Sherwood says that he doesn't know exactly what the number is, that's why we have fiscal notes to try to determine what the closest number is as possible to provide success for the intent of the legislation. But no one can tell me that 440,000 hours to get the waiver here is not substantial and not required.
Senator Machicki.
I'm not sure that's what that page says, but
first page.
I think so. I always feel like we're these are incredible people. These are wonderful people, and the organization is a bureaucracy that does things a certain way. Most of it's born in D.C. and we inherit it, and that's the problem. Is it does things a certain way, and that certain way isn't working. It's just not working. And so when you feel resistance. We all support services for the disabled, for seniors, and temporarily for those that need the help to get back on their feet, always. Certain individuals in certain parts of the state are always going to need Medicaid services that are healthy. That's just life. That's just how it goes. We think the percentage is too high and growing, and the challenge is working around the edges, outside of the box, to make a program like this function for the good of those recipients, ultimately, their children, their grandchildren, and our state as a whole, so that we can continue offering those services to those that truly need them all the time. That's the challenge. You have a certain set of rules. Please help us to understand how we can push them to make this work while spending what needs to be spent, but not supplementing other programs in the department. I think that's probably the frustration or the push that you're hearing. We want to support to make it successful, but I'm not sure that we want to supplement other areas of the department to make it happen.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Ms. Windham, did you state that TANF currently has a work requirement, or what did I hear the exchange with Senator Von Imhoff and you earlier about 1,500 individuals and a $3 million contract?
Madam Chair, that's correct. An ATAP recipient must participate in work programs, and there's a lifetime limit for the benefit. In some areas, we contracted out. In Anchorage, we contracted out to Nine Star. Their contract is about $3 million a year for about 1,500 cases a month. Some of those, I mean, that's the monthly caseload. Some ATAP folks are only on for a couple months. Some are on for a year or two. So I can't define how long right now. I can't define how long they work with each client.
So of the 1,500 that we're looking at there, that would be over 15,000 a year if those were unique cases. Is that accurate?
I believe so. I'd have to do the math.
Well, 1,500 times 10 is 15,000. So we'd be shooting towards 18,000 if each one of those cases were individual at the time, which is very close to the 22,000 that we're talking about here. People go on and off, and they repeat on and off the system. And so when Senator Machicki was questioning the math on 400,000 hours plus, people that are on Medicaid are on and off Medicaid, and that creates the tracking problem for the department. Anyway, Senator Stevens, thank you for joining us. I've been here some time. We have fiscal note 2 in front of us, OMB component number 236, and I have suggested that we strike all of the individual full-time positions and look at a different outsourcing method, not necessarily decreasing the funding, though some of the decrease should go down in funding, and we're having a conversation around that issue now. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, and I would like to move on to the second fiscal note, the capital, $6 million, did you get an actual estimate on that capital? I see like two sentences, maybe three in the back, two short paragraphs that talk about $6 million. Can you tell me how you backed up that number so that we know that that's a credible number or whether that should be reduced? Ms. Windham.
Madam Chair, we did check with, we have a program management office that is in charge of updating ARIES and keeping that that project going. They did the estimate of what the cost would be to update ARIES to put in work requirements, although we do have, as we have talked about, we do have work requirements for ATAP. None of that programming is in ARIES for Medicaid. There's no way for us to tell the system this person doesn't qualify for Medicaid because they're not complying with work requirements. So I can get more information about how they came to that number, but they are the ones that came to that number.
Ms. Windham, could we run it through ATAPs? Since it's an existing system, and then cross-feed it over to the Medicaid system versus creating a new system in ARES?
Madam Chair, there would need to be some programming in ARES. Yes, we could use, we have a separate case management system where we track what the ATAP clients are doing for work. Are they volunteering? Are they exempt? We have that. So we likely could use that, but then we'd have to build the interface to ARES, and ARES is rules-based, so it has all the Medicaid rules in it. So we would also have to add the rule that they have to be working, and we'd have to add new fields to track what they're doing for work, or are they volunteering, or are they exempt. All of those things would have to be built into the ARES system, as well as the denials for not complying with the requirement.
I'm wondering why we can't just take the ATAP's report and use it for the individual clients versus building the new system out for that. It's a state system, mm-hmm. federally certified. But
the ARES system that has the MAGI Medicaid that we're talking about here, we can't, it's pretty automated. The rules are in there and they're automated. So although, yes, we have the ability to track what somebody's doing in the case management system that we use for the ATAP clients, we don't have that connection to ARES to let ARES know that this person is not in compliance and we need to close their case. Or, yes, they're in compliance, so their benefits can continue. So there's no way to do that right now.
Thank you for that answer. If we could go to fiscal note number 3, we don't have much time, I believe. I'm sorry, it's not 3. Let me look. It's the $20 million one. $20 million question. Fiscal note number 4 is work services related for public assistance. It's OMB component 2337. And here we're not asking for positions. We're just asking for $20 million of general fund. Can you talk to the committee about the grants and benefits that you're talking about on this fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair. We looked at our ATAP recipients at what kind of supportive services we provide to them. We're talking gas money, a bus pass, training. GEDs aren't free. You have to help pay for those. Vocational training, and on average, we spend about $1,000 a year for an ATAP client for supportive services, so that's how we came to that figure.
So for me, again, this is a Department of Labor request versus a Health and Human Service request. So again, I think the numbers are high for money request here, but I think that we have opportunities for to have a different department do the work. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it's a two-part process. I support a work requirement for Medicaid for healthy individuals, and I support the Department of Labor helping us comprehensively on how they're going to help train for those that have the opportunity for employment to help train and place those individuals. There are plenty of volunteer opportunities in the most remote places of rural Alaska where people can contribute as well if there's not a work availability. But I do think we need to hear more from the Department of Labor on their role. I don't think this is not a HESS responsibility. This is a Department of Labor responsibility. I'd like to hear more from them on what a comprehensive plan might look like. There's probably a chance they have something in mind that's further developed.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. With that, does the department have any closing conversation or thoughts for consideration on the fiscal notes before the body?
Madam Chair, no. I think we've made the point we feel like we need to make. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Sherwood, Ms. Windham, we appreciate all that you do for those that are in need in our state, and you get the tough questions from the Senate Finance Committee, which makes it even extra difficult. So we appreciate that you try to provide us as much information as you can and carry the wishes of the administration who's asking you to engage with the committee in particular directions. So please know that we all want the same thing. Senator Machicki talked about that multiple times. We want people to make sure that they're covered when they can and when they can help themselves. to be able to find an opportunity to do that, and this is one step in that direction. Some of the dollars associated with that appear, from my perspective, to be higher than are needed. And again, it's a plan that's moving forward, and from my perspective, I'd like to see a little bit more of a private sector look at how we engage those that might be seeking assistance from the state to be able to provide for themselves and be successful in their home communities. Is there other comments from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think everybody at this table and all the legislators in this building want to have citizens in Alaska more productive and contribute to the economy and to help support their families. That is a good thing. There is a problem with the Medicaid program. It did expand, and it is costing the state of Alaska millions of dollars, and there's question on whether or not we're going to be able to continue to provide the services in this particular area when it's competing with a lot of other things that are vying for limited dollars in our state: education, public safety, a slew of other programs. But this is one of the areas that I have grave concern, and to find common ground is to address it, to reverse the trend, is could be very contentious, but something from my viewpoint needs to be done.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. With that, I'd like to ask for those of you on those two particular fiscal notes, we will try to reach out to the Department of Labor to have them here this afternoon. I know it's a busy day, but we'll try to bring the fiscal notes back up this afternoon to discuss them more thoroughly. Again, the issue for me is embedding another 50 people if we already have the positions but don't have the dollars associated with them. So, Deputy Commissioner, if you can figure that out for me by 1 o'clock this afternoon, that would be helpful to understand your vacancy rate and how many positions do not have dollars attached with them, so that at least we can consider that, as well as the vacancy rate here. Is there other information that we can provide the committee at 1:30, 2 o'clock, just depends. I apologize to those who are trying to follow all these conversations. We are trying to work on an operating budget, a capital budget, and multiple bills in our committee and try to get them prepared. Senator Hoffman.
If we are going to have the Department of Labor, it would be interesting to see if they could give a snapshot view of what's happening with unemployment in the state of Alaska, you know, what jobs are available, and what are the trends today? You know, are the jobs available? Because I think that that is an integral part of resolving the question. Government, I know, plays a big role in the economy of Alaska, the state, the educational system, the university. So if they could give us some information along those lines, it would be helpful to me.
Ms. Teal, have you captured that so that we can get that information to the Department of Labor? Thank you. A head is nodding yes. We would also like either the commissioner or representative at this afternoon's meeting to be able to discuss current programs that are already functioning inside of the Department of Labor to support this potential group that could lower the cost of the fiscal notes before us. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the Department of Labor would also be able to tell us the methodology and how it's changed on counting unemployment since the Great Recession. The unemployment in the United States is at 4.1, but there's a cohort of people out there between the ages of 24 and I believe it's 40 that has completely quit looking for work. So if the department would expound on that a little bit more, I'd appreciate that too.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bishop. And for the general public who's following, we have a former commissioner of labor at our table, which is why we're interested in and may have a more intimate understanding of what the Department of Labor does and what they could do for this group of people that may want to go to work but are finding themselves in the Medicaid program with little options available to them to actually work and provide for their family. So thank you, former Commissioner Bishop and current Senator Bishop. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, my question is how we can invest a proportion of the $1.2 or $3 billion UGF we're investing in HES today in the Department of Labor and spend it once to help develop employment and skills rather than spending it forever in a growing population of folks dependent on Medicaid. So that's why I think it's a two-part program. I think it is both departments. But what I'd like to learn more about is constraints on the 1115 waiver. 1115 waiver. I mean, the department does things a certain way, and so do the feds. But sometimes I think there is room to push, and I don't think they're programmed to do that. I think they're programmed to kind of follow to the letter, and I'd like to know where there's room around the edges to privatize as much of that as possible.
Thank you. Other comments from committee members? I did hear the bells ring. I plan on bringing this bill back up before us this afternoon. The meeting may be delayed based on meetings that are scheduled. With that, bells are ringing. Please go to the floor as soon as possible. We're adjourned.